Have you ever been on a crowded elevator full of strangers? The ones that are really slow, they have to go up like 20 floors, and you're elbow to elbow with somebody, and the elevator probably not isn't as clean as it should be. How do you feel? Are you ready to get off? And it stops at every floor, of course, along the way too. So what are you doing while you're sitting there elbow to elbow with everybody? What do you find yourself doing? Looking up at the little lights above or below, wherever they may be, counting the floor, saying, you know, how much longer? Kind of looking at the person next to you quickly to, you know, maybe I don't want to be that close to that person. And so you move, you just say, Matt, can we ever get there? And so you start fidgeting your fingers, you get a little nervous, and finally, you know, it's just not a comfortable feeling to be in a crowded place, especially if you have claustrophobia. You know, an elevator like that is not the place you'd like to be. And so it has to do with our personal space. We have this space that is particularly ours. How large is your personal space? Well, there's a study that was done a few years back, and they determined what personal space actually was. We actually have these little areas around us that we define. And usually our personal space where we don't want anybody really, really close to us is about a foot and a half to 2 feet. That's our personal bubble. And people, you just don't want them in there unless you invite them. It's called a bubble of security. And it can't be seen, but you can feel it. You know, when somebody gets too close, you can feel it. And so when they get closer, how do we feel? We start feeling threatened or intimidated when people get that close to us. In 1966, there was an anthropologist and researcher. His name was Edward Hall. In 1966, he did a study of this particular thing right here. And we have these invisible concentric circles that we have around us. We have this invisible ring around us that... The public, you know, people were usually comfortable with people being 12 to 24 feet away from us. You know, we're not too threatened then. And then it starts getting a little closer with a social ring where our friends and, you know, we hang out with people. You know, they can get a little closer, but still a little bit of difference right there. And then we get to our personal ring, which, you know, our family, our friends, those we love, you know, that can come in a little closer to us. We want them in there, you know, we like them there. But then we got that 2 feet away that, you know, you just don't like people invading, like unless they're your spouse, you know, every now and then, you know, you want your spouse to be a little closer than 10 feet away. It works in a marriage that way if you're, you know, you get a little closer every now and then. And our children, you know, we like our children to be close to us, hug up to us. We want our children in our personal space. So we allow them in there as well. But if a stranger comes into that particular place, how do we feel? I used to go to college years ago at Western Kentucky University. And there was a friend of mine there, and he's one of those people who when he talked to you, he'd get right up in your face. And I don't care how you move, you know, it's like a magnet. He'd go with you whichever direction you went. And it was just uncomfortable, you know. And, you know, sometimes maybe a tic-tac or two would probably be helpful too. But, you know, we don't like that personal space invaded that particular much. But in some cultures, they believe in hugging and closeness. Every time you walk in, it's a hug, a kiss on the cheek. That's some cultures. In some cultures, you know, it's just a bow. You don't get within certain, you know, you have to know where you were. But there's just certain times that people want to be left alone and just stay, you know, out of my space. And so this theory of personal space was first noted by a Swiss zoologist named Heini Heidegger. And he studied this the same thing with animals. And you know in the animal kingdom, it's the same thing. Animals, you know, if a certain animal is far away, they kind of ignore it. But what happens when you start getting a couple dogs up close together, too close to each other? The teeth come out, they start getting angry, and it's not a pretty sight. In the human world, it happens that way sometimes too, but not as much as in the animal world. But the idea of personal space isn't new. Even in the Talmud, that's the codified rabbinic commentary. How do you like that for some good word? Thank you. I went to school for 4 years and learned that. That's good. Hope I got my money's worth. And there's a difference in personal space. Within the Jewish tradition, there is a difference in personal space. It extends to 6 to 8 feet around a person. So it's not just one or two. You stayed 6 to 8 feet away from somebody. And it, many times it's inappropriate to come within that space. And so even when Jesus was on the earth, there was this concept of personal space. You didn't invade it. Then come a man named Jesus who just totally destroyed that theory. He came within people's personal space. He came up to them. They loved him there. He met their need, and he made no apologies for coming close to them. He would reach out, and he would touch them. He would heal them. Those who had diseases, those who were untouchable, unclean, Jesus would come close to them and touch them. The people around him say, "What are you doing? You're not even supposed to be in the same vicinity to them, let alone talking to them, close to them. And you're reaching out, touching them? Don't you know they're unclean? You're going to catch what they have. Don't touch them. If you do, you're going to be in the same boat that they are." But Jesus ignored these prohibitions. He ignored them, and he did the right thing. These people were poor. They were pitiable. You should be felt sorry for. They needed to have someone touch them that cared. Think about this for a moment. Think that you were one of these people who all of a sudden contracted this little white spot on your hand. And you were excommunicated out of the city. You were away from everybody. And everywhere you go, you had to say, "Unclean, unclean." You couldn't talk to your friends, your family, anybody. You could never have that personal touch. Never again would they touch their family, never hug their children, kiss their wives, their husband. They would die alone. Imagine, just take a moment to think of what that must have felt like for these people. Besides the fact you've got this horrible disease, you also have this horrible loneliness. And then comes Jesus, who breaks these prohibitions. And he encourages us to love and to touch. And so now place this in the context of the communion service. As you know, in the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, part of our service is the ordinance of humility, better known as foot washing. It's an age-old practice. You know, it's been around for many centuries. This isn't something new to our church. They did this for many years. It's just kind of come out of favor in the last few hundred years. And it's fallen away from churches. It's an important part of our message. It's part of touch and knowing somebody. Think of the symbolism of what it really means and why it's necessary to reform this act. Sometimes we think, what is the purpose of taking out a basin and washing somebody's feet? Think of how much is missed by the people who cannot or do not kneel down and humble themselves in front of their brother or their sister. To kneel down and touch someone's bare feet. We have this zone. We don't want people touching us. And now all of a sudden they're going to touch my feet. Why is this necessary? Especially when the person is a stranger. It's easy when it's your friend, or maybe not so much with your friend sometimes, but your family member, your spouse. It's easy to do that. But all of a sudden you find some stranger off the street, somebody who comes in whose shoes look like they've been, you know, through a few battles. And you humble yourself before them. How does it make this person feel? How did the people feel when Jesus touched them? How did they feel? They felt wanted. They felt loved. We miss out on that when we fail to humble ourselves in front of our brothers and sisters. And this is what Jesus did for his disciples. You remember the story of the upper room? They'd been out walking down the dusty streets of Jerusalem. Besides dusty streets, there were a lot of animals on those streets. And so they were walking through more than just dust on those streets. And they had sandals on. So their feet were not the cleanest things in the room. So the custom was when they went into a place such as this for a meal, that a servant or a slave, a doulos, I'm getting my money's worth today from my college, would come and would cleanse the feet of all the people there, you know, Cleansing was part of the ceremony of the Jewish faith. Well, in this particular instance, they came in. They all sat down, crossed their arms, look around. Nobody to wash the feet. A crazy quietness in the room. You could hear a pin drop. You know, well, what do we do now? And so we're told in John 13, verses 4 and 5, what had happened. It says, he riseth from supper and laid aside his garments and took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poureth water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. So Jesus, the night before he's to be crucified, takes on the role of a servant. He took a towel and a basin. He became a servant and began to wash their feet. This was unheard of. A rabbi, a teacher, never, ever, ever would touch the feet of his student. That was just not, it was unthinkable. One would, and a student would never allow his teacher to do this. It was the ultimate thing that they could not do. This was a duty for a common servant. It was not a duty for a teacher. But Jesus took on this role of a servant. But he also was showing them how to be a leader, to be a servant, to be a leader, a servant leader. That was what Jesus was trying to teach. And so he girded himself. He took his outer garment off and girded a towel around his waist. And he stooped to wash the feet of his students. And he touched them in a way that they had never been touched before. So in verse 6, no wonder Peter recoiled when he said, Lord, you're going to wash my feet? And the emphasis in the Greek is upon the pronouns you and my. Dost thou, or do you wash my feet? Are you kidding me? Some commentators have even suggested that Peter pulled his legs back up towards himself like, uh-uh, you're not going to wash my feet. You'll never do it. You're the teacher. I'm the student. I'm your disciple. There's no way that you're ever going to wash my feet. And Jesus, how did Jesus respond to him? If I don't wash your feet, you will have no part of me. Never. In the Greek, it's a strongly implied word, very strongly. Never. That means throughout eternity, never will you wash my feet. Now, Peter, he had a tendency sometimes to be a little forceful in his outbursts. This was no exception. This was classic Peter right here. Peter had a tendency to say what he was thinking. And those words were his words of self-confidence and not of surrender. And Jesus saying, you'll have no part of me, Jesus was saying, this was the only way that you could ever have part with Christ. And so Jesus was pointing to Peter that this attitude of independence was not something that a follower of Jesus would have, but they would be a humble servant. So then Peter said something interesting. Well, Lord, you know, if you're going to wash my feet, you're going to do my hands and my head as well. You know, do the whole job. If a little's good, a lot's got to be good. He said, not my feet only. That was classic of Peter. Peter decided he would try to help the master out a little bit. You know, this will, you know, really get things going well. But he didn't understand the significance of the act. But there was a life-changing touch in that room that night. There was personal space encroachment in that room. That's how some might have viewed it. You know, that Jesus just went and encroached on his personal space. But the 12 didn't see it that way. They saw it as a touch of love, of compassion, of service. That's how they understood it. Amazing that they understood that. But they didn't completely understand what they had just experienced. And we know this because of what was said in the following verse, in verse 12, when Jesus asked them, do you know what I have done to you? Do you understand? Part of the significance of this act had already present was Jesus' unselfish love. Jesus bent down and washed their dirty, filthy feet. But the full significance hadn't yet been revealed. They still didn't completely understand. They still had some blank looks on their face, like, I don't know. Look at each other like, what's he talking about? So Jesus explained to them in verse 14 to 15, if then your Lord and teacher have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. Let's stop there for a second. Imagine what they thought when they heard that. It's one thing for Jesus to wash their feet and say, okay, I understand that. Now you expect me to wash his feet or his feet? That was, wow. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Jesus was doing more than just giving an example of service. He was instituting an ordinance to be followed by his believers. And not just the believers at that time, but he set an example for believers throughout the ages to the end of time. It was to give us an example of how we should humble ourselves before others. And the service is part of that significance. And it has a threefold significance. First, it symbolizes cleansing from sin. What is the original cleansing from sin that we do as Christians? Baptism. And so baptism symbolizes a person's original cleansing from sin. That is when you first originally are cleansed from the sin. But in between baptism and whatever time we're in now, sometimes we get a little bit dirty in between, and we need a reminder that we still need that cleansing. And so the ordinance of foot washing helps us to remember it's a symbolic rededication, a symbolic rebaptism, re-giving ourselves back to the Lord. And as in the case of baptism, the act itself has no significance. The act of being dunked in the water, of washing feet, mean nothing without a repentance and thorough conversion. They are just works if we don't have that heart conversion and then sin be expelled from the life. We have to be allowing Christ to continually work in our lives to overcome our sins day after day. And then only when there has been an appropriate preliminary heart preparation, then does that service assume the meaning that Christ had for us. And second, it symbolizes a renewed consecration to service. The one who stoops and washes the feet of his brethren indicate their willingness to engage in the service of Christ, no matter how menial or how insignificant it may seem. We will do whatever Christ asks us to do. And three, it typifies Christian fellowship. And so this ordinance is a suitable preparation for the communion service which follows. So what kind of leader does this thing? What kind of king? One who understands grace and one who dispenses mercy. The one who knows that his subjects can only be cleansed by his healing touch.